Okay, tonight we're going to cover Judges chapter 19. It's a pretty lengthy chapter. It's got 30 verses in it, but I think pretty sure we can get through it in one sitting. This is, I think, without doubt, one of the darkest chapters in the Bible about human nature. And we'll just jump right into the text. It says in Judges chapter 19, verse 1, it says, "Now it came about in those days when there was no king in Israel." And that statement has been stated before, and it's designed to bring the reader, to orient the reader to the writer's perspective. And again, we've talked about that the most likely author of the book of Judges is Samuel, and of course he was alive among the first two kings, be it Saul and David. And the idea that the king in Israel was the individual that the Lord used to enforce his law among God's people. So again, the writer's giving us something that was before his day, but explains somewhat of the cultural setting. He says, again, "Now it came about in those days when there was no king in Israel, that there was a certain Levite staying in the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim who took a concubine." Now, if you look at dictionaries, you'll get different views on a concubine. The Hebrew word is pelegesh, and a concubine is a legal wife. We should understand that she is a legal wife, but she is of secondary rank. If you look at the footnote, a concubine was a legal wife of secondary rank and was part of the practice of polygamy. And under the law, a concubine was promised food, clothing, and a place to live. If she had children, she was also promised conjugal rights or visits concerning her children. So when we understand this, we should understand it, again, from the framework of the Mosaic law and the rights and the practice that was going on in that day. So this Levite, he was living in the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim, who took a concubine for himself from Bethlehem in Judah. It says, "But his concubine played the harlot against him." Now, what's interesting is if you look at the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, it doesn't say that she played the harlot. It actually says that she got angry at him. As a matter of fact, the NET Bible, the New English Translation, actually translates it that way. Not that she played the harlot, but that she got angry at him. And the text goes on to say, "And she went away from him to her father's house in Bethlehem in Judah, and was there for a period of 4 months." Now, you know, if we go with that and we ask, well, why would she be angry at him? Well, as we learn something about his character a little later on, it could be a somewhat of a preview. That maybe she left him because the guy was just a total jerk. We don't know that, but again, from the text, we learn some things about his character. But again, there's a question about what her behavior was and why she left. Now, verse 3, it says, "Then her husband arose and went after her to speak tenderly to her." And the Hebrew is literally the Hebrew word lev, which is the word for heart. And it's literally that he spoke to her heart. Now, this to me is in one sense a demonstration of emotional compassion. Although I think it's a shallow love at best, considering his later actions, as we're going to see. But it says that he went after her to speak tenderly to her. And, you know, I take this as a very humanistic love. I take it as an emotional love. I don't think there's any integrity here. I don't think there's any substance to the man as to why he loves her. I think it's totally selfish reasoning. And, of course, if we understand what Jeremiah 17 has to say about the human heart, that it is sick, that it is wicked, who can know it? I think when somebody comes and they love with their heart, with their own human ability, I think we should understand that in a very sinful way, is the way that we should understand that. So he comes to her, and it says that he went after her to speak tenderly to her, to speak to her heart. And here's the purpose. It says, "In order to bring her back, and he takes with him his servant and a pair of donkeys, So she brought him into her father's house, and when the girl's father saw him, he was glad to meet him. Now, this could be for a number of reasons. It could be that, first of all, if there was unfaithfulness, if a family member, like a daughter in this case, had proven to be unfaithful, that she abandons the relationship, then there was a shame that was brought upon the person. And that shame extended to the family member as well. So the father-in-law is very happy to see him come to try to get his daughter back, his wife back. And so perhaps he's hoping that their relationship would be restored and again that the social shame of the family would be removed. Now we have this interesting section here with the father-in-law where he's almost the over-polite host. It says here that his father-in-law, the girl's father, detained him and he remained with him 3 days, so they ate and drank and lodged together. Now on the fourth day they got up early in the morning and he prepared to go, and the girl's father said to his son-in-law, "Sustain yourself with a piece of bread and afterward you may go." And this is part of his tactic to try to get him to stay. And he's a little pushy about it. So again he says, "Sustain yourself with a piece of bread, afterward you may go." So both of them sat down and ate and drank together. And the girl's father said to the man, "Please be willing to spend the night and let your heart be merry." Then the man arose to go, but his father-in-law urged him so that he spent the night there again. And finally, on the fifth day, he arose to go early in the morning, and the girl's father said, "Please sustain yourself and wait until afternoon." So both of them ate. And when the man arose to go along with his concubine and servant, his father-in-law, the girl's father, said to him, "Behold now, the day has dawned to a close. Please spend the night. Lo, the day is coming to an end. Spend the night here that your heart may be merry. Then tomorrow you may arise for your journey so that you may go home." So again, he seems to be a little bit pushy as far as, you know, trying to play the polite host here. It's like he's going overboard with it. But the man was not willing, that is the Levite. He was not willing to spend the night, so he arose and departed and came to a place opposite Jebus. Now, we have in here parenthetically where it says that is Jerusalem, because at this time Jebus did not have the name Jerusalem yet. But so that the author tells us the location, he puts in there parenthetically, giving the designation that this is Jerusalem. It says, "And there were with him a pair of saddled donkeys. His concubine also was with him. And when they were near Jebus, the day was almost gone, and the servant said to his master, 'Please come and let us turn aside into this city of the Jebusites and spend the night there.' However, his master said to him, 'We will not turn aside into the city of foreigners who are not the sons of Israel.'" Now remember that Jerusalem did not become an Israelite city until it was conquered by David. So again, this is quite a number of years later. So at this time, it's still under Canaanite control. So the Jebusites were native Canaanites who, in effect, had not been driven out of the land. But he says, "But we will go on as far as Gibeah." So he's trying to go into territory where he's going to feel safer, that is, among his fellow Israelites. Verse 13, he said to his servant, "Come and let us approach one of these places and we will spend the night in Gibeah or Ramah." And so he wrongly assumes that, again, he will find safety among his fellow Israelites. We're going to learn that's not the case. Verse 14, so they passed along and went their way, and the sun set on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. So we have there the region of Benjamin being mentioned. Verse 15, they turned aside there in order to enter and lodge in Gibeah. And when they entered, they sat down in the open square of the city, for no one took them into his house to spend the night. And this is unusual because there's no display of hospitality. It's not like they had hotels there.
It's unusual that no one...
Right, it's unusual that nobody displayed hospitality, that's what I meant. So they're there, and they're out in this open square, and it says that nobody takes them in order to spend the night. So again, no display of hospitality. Verse 16, then behold, an old man was coming out of the field from his work at evening. Now the man was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was staying in Gibeah, but the men of the place were Benjamites. And he lifted up his eyes and saw the traveler in the open square of the city, and the old man said, "Where are you going? And where do you come from?" So he's asking, you know, he realizes that he's a traveler. And he said to him, verse 18, he said to him, "We are passing from Bethlehem in Judah to the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim, for I am from there. And I went to Bethlehem in Judah, but now I am going to my house, and no man will take me into his house." Verse 19, and he says, "Yet there is both straw and fodder for our donkeys, and also bread and wine for me, your maidservant, and the young man who is with your servants. There is no lack of anything." So it's not like he's going to come into somebody's home and take their resources. He has food for his animals. He has food for himself, his traveling party. So he says, you know, we're able to sustain ourselves. We just need a place to sleep for the night. Verse 20, and the old man said, "Peace to you. Only let me take care of all your needs. However, do not spend the night in the open square." Now, this right here and some of the forwarding account here is reminiscent of what happened with Lot and his two guests over in Genesis 19. Go with me over there real quick to Genesis chapter 19. And we'll see some of the parallel here from Genesis 19 into Judges chapter 19. In Genesis 19:1, it says, "Now the two angels," and this is where God is going to destroy Sodom. And we know the historical account here. And it opens up by saying, "Now the Lord," now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening as Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. And when Lot saw them, he arose to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground. And he said, "Now behold, my lords, please turn aside into your servant's house and spend the night, and wash your feet that you may rise early and go on your way." So again, showing good hospitality. And they said, however, "No, but we shall spend the night in the open square." Yet he urged them strongly so that they turned aside to him and entered his house, and he prepared a feast for them, and he baked unleavened bread and they ate. And before they lay down, the men of the city... the men of Sodom surrounded the house, both young and old, and all the people from every quarter. And they called to Lot and said to him, Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may have relations with them." And the connotation there is sexual relations. Verse 6, "But Lot went out to them at the doorway and shut the door behind him and said to them, 'Please, my brothers, do not act wickedly. Now behold," and here's a weakness on Lot's part, he says, "Behold, I have two daughters who have not had relations with man. Please let me bring them out to you and do to them whatever you like, only do nothing to these men inasmuch as they have come under the shelter of my roof." And this is a serious character flaw in Lot, that he's willing to throw his two daughters out to these sexual terrorists. But they said, "Stand aside," and they got a little pushy. "Furthermore," they said, "this one came in as an alien, and already he is acting like our judge. Now we will treat you worse than them." So they pressed hard against Lot and came near to break the door. But when the men reached out their hands and brought Lot into the house and shut the door, and of course the angels here have supernatural ability. It says they struck the men who were there at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they wearied themselves trying to find the door. Even in their blind stupor, their sinful sexual drive is so strong that they're groping, trying to find the door to continue on with their nefarious act. It's just quite amazing. Anyway, getting back to the text here. So verse 20, "The old man said, 'Peace to you, only let me take care of all your needs. However, do not spend the night in the open square.'" So again, he's echoing the words here of Lot from the text we just read. "So he took him into his house and gave the donkeys fodder, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. And while they were celebrating, behold, the men of the city, certain worthless fellows." Some translations refer to this as sons of wickedness. or sons of nothingness. The Hebrew is B'nai Belial. And Belial is a term that was used in the New Testament with regard to Christ, if you remember. It was a very derogatory term, but it means literally sons of wickedness or worthless fellows is a good translation. But again, there were certain worthless fellows surrounded the house, pounding the door, and they spoke to the owner of the house, the old man, saying, "Bring out the man who came into your house that we may have relations with him." And again, the connotation there is sexual. And again, we might describe these as very similar to the men of the city of Sodom as sexual terrorists. Verse 23, "Then the man, the owner of the house, went out to them and said to them, 'No, my fellows, please do not act so wickedly since this man has come into my house.'" Now, again, in this culture at this time, hospitality was considered, again, a very sacred act, such that it was not only displaying kindness to the person who was traveling through your town, but it also required the individual to provide protection for the person who came under his roof. So again, he says, "Do not commit this act of folly." Verse 24, he says, "Here is my virgin daughter and his concubine." So in this verse right here, the old man offers both women, that is his daughter and the man's concubine, in order to protect his primary guest. Now you can imagine the daughter and the concubine at this point are probably a little upset and probably alarmed over what is going on. He says, "Please let me bring them out that you may ravish them and do whatever you wish." Now, this is a breakdown here of protection, of love. He says, "But do not commit such an act of folly against this man." But the men would not listen to him. So the man, now some have taken the man to be the old man. I kind of lean that it's the Levite, although there's probably a little wiggle room there. But it says, "So the man seized his concubine." And when it says his concubine, I take it to be the Levite's concubine. And one can imagine, well, he says here, "So the man seized his concubine and brought her out to them." So in effect, he throws her out in order to save himself. And one can imagine that the concubine probably put up a bit of a fight with the man who was throwing her out the door to these sexual terrorists. But it's there. "So the man seized his concubine and brought her out to them, and they raped her and abused her all night until morning. Then they let her go at the approach of dawn." And what a horrible picture. Absolutely horrible. If the man had an ounce of integrity, he would have fought to protect her. He would not have let this happen. He would have tried to guard her at all costs. And even as a final gesture of protection, he would have put himself in harm's way in order to protect his wife. But he doesn't do that. He does just the opposite. So again, it puts a question mark over the love that he had when he went to get her back. What kind of love is that? Well, it's obviously not much of a love if he's willing to throw her out and let her be treated this way. Verse 26, "As the day began to dawn, the woman came and fell down at the doorway of the man's house." So she crawled back to the house where her master was until full daylight. So there she lays at the doorway of the house. And then in verse 27, it says, "When her master arose in the morning and opened the doors of the house, he went out to go on his way. Then behold, his concubine was lying at the doorway of the house with her hands on the threshold." And so what a desperate picture of her laying sprawled out with her hands just somewhat clutching the threshold of the door. And he says to her, "Get up and let us go." Well, that's a pretty callous statement.
It's almost like kicking her. Come on.
Yeah, it's almost like kicking her. Like, come on, you've had your night. Let's go. And I'm not even sure that she's dead. It says, "But he said to her, 'Get up and let's go.'"
Let us go. Dead.
Huh?
I think she's dead.
Yeah, but the text doesn't say. It's a question mark. He says, but there was no answer. So the woman was either dead or unconscious. Now, what he does to her body is pretty dark. I think it would add to the darkness of it if, in fact, she were still alive. So verse 29. So again, picking up, let us go. Then he placed her on the donkey, and the man arose and went to his home. Now, again, he's appearing very apathetic. And when he entered his house, he took a knife and laid hold of his concubine and cut her in 12 pieces. So at this point, he's disrespecting her dead body, which should have at least gotten a proper burial, but he doesn't even do that. And so he cuts up her body into 12 pieces, limb by limb, literally bone by bone. And, you know, you think about a Levite. A Levite was one who was supposed to serve at the tabernacle, who was accustomed to dissecting animals. So this wouldn't have been something that would have been overly shocking to him because of his experience of cutting up animals, you know, on the altar. But this is a human body. This is his wife, his concubine. So he cuts her up limb by limb and sent her throughout the territory of Israel. And what he's doing here by sending out these body parts to the tribes of Israel is, in effect, he's demanding justice, is what he's doing. Now, is it justice for him or is it justice for his concubine? I think it's more for him. I think his character is such that it's more about how it affects him, not his concubine.
So there's so many different aspects of shame throughout the story.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Verse 30, and all who saw it said, nothing like this has ever happened or been seen from the day when the sons of Israel came up from the land of Egypt to this day. Consider it, take counsel, and speak up. And so the verse here, the chapter ends with the final verse, where at least the Israelites who received the body parts at least began to question. Because you must assume that there was some sort of note or some sort of explanation that went with each body part explaining what it is, where it came from, why they're receiving it, and basically designing to prompt them to consider what action needs to take place. Now, this is a very horrible scene. Again, one of the darkest in the Bible, I would argue. And yet, what it results in is a civil war and a purging of the wickedness that was going on during this time in Israel because they had so degenerated. And remember, chapter 17 and 18 deals with the Levite, the grandson of Moses, who introduces idolatry, and that, of course, spreads to the tribe of Dan. Here we have the Benjamites here behaving very poorly, but it shows how influential the surrounding Canaanite culture had become upon God's people, such that they were not following the law at all. Granted, they didn't have the spirit in the sense that we do and the supernatural endowment that we have with the indwelling of the Holy Spirit that guides us according to the word and sustains us. But they still had the law and they had the ability to walk in the light of God's truth. And, you know, I was thinking earlier this week, because I love Psalms, and I was thinking of Psalm chapter 119, and I think of it for personal reasons, but personal application, but it's applicable on many levels. But you think of Psalm 119, verse 9, David poses the question. He says, how can a young man keep his way pure? Now, this is pure before God. This is according to the expectations of God, the standards of God, the character of God, the holiness of God. So how can a young man keep his way pure? By keeping it according to your word. And then in verse 11, he says, your word I have treasured in my heart. Why? So that I may not sin against you. So the word of God had a transforming and consecrating effect in the lives of God's people when they meditated upon it, when they learned from it, when they walked in it. And so was this also true for the Israelites during the time of the judges? Absolutely. But what had happened is the law of God had been so set aside and so ignored that what happens is people naturally begin to become affected by the surrounding culture. I mean, think about how we're impacted. We're impacted by television, by music, by literature, by conversations. These are the avenues of where information comes to us. But it expresses the values of the culture. And the values of the worldly culture either exclude God. They'll talk about anything and everything. They'll talk about every problem and every solution. But they'll do it in such a way that God is conveniently removed. Or if they do bring God in, it's a very superficial or superstitious way of viewing God, not certainly in a biblical way, but in a very pagan way of understanding God. So they'll give some lip service to God, but not according to Scripture. And can Christians be influenced by that? Absolutely. And so it's so important that we be on guard against such influences. But again, you know, when I read through this chapter, I was just so, in one sense, disturbed by it. But then on the other hand, I began to think about how real to life this is. Mm-hmm. And I was sharing with you last week about, you know, when I was living in Vegas back in the early 80s, how there, my friend of mine, David, when I was in junior high, had found the remains of a body that had been cut up in a dumpster. And I remember it was on the news. He was walking down an alley and he saw what looked like part of a mannequin's arm sticking out of a dumpster. And he goes over to pick it up thinking, cool, mannequin's arm. You know, he's going to play with it, you know, only to pull it out and realize that it was a real human arm. And then upon looking in the dumpster, he saw bits and pieces of a woman's body. It's an Asian woman. And I don't remember the story, but her husband had cut her up in the bathtub and sought to dispose of her remains in the dumpster. And, you know, those sorts of stories are not completely uncommon. You hear stories like that. So when I read this, I thought to myself, you know, this could very easily be a story that we read, you know, in the Dallas Morning News, you know, or see on TV. This is not so outlandish in our own day, that the corruption and the depravity of the human heart is such that it's beyond people to behave this way, even in our own day, because people are people, whether it's 3,000 years ago, like the story we're reading here in the book of Judges, or in our own day. Mm-hmm. And as far as, you know, him throwing the concubine out, or even offering his daughter, or the old man offering his daughter, I knew a young woman in Vegas, knew her quite well, as a matter of fact, that at a very young age, her mom was getting her high on cocaine at the age of 10 and 11. And when she was, you know, even as young as 12 and 13, would prostitute her daughter out to satisfy her drug addiction. And so, you know, here's a young girl being exposed to the ravages of men, also that mom can sustain her drug addiction, be it cocaine or LSD or meth or whatever it was that she needed for the day. And so the fact that a parent would do this, and again, this is not completely unheard of, you know, even in our own day, in our own culture, that people would behave this way towards their own children if it satisfies some selfish, sinful desire. Now, in the case of the old man, what was it? It was the protection of his honor, as warped as that was, to protect his primary guest. In the case of the Levite throwing her out, it was to protect his own skin, because better her than me, you know. And it's such a contradiction, because here is a man who goes after his wife supposedly for love, speaking tenderly to her, speaking to her heart, and yet, what kind of love is that? Because of the way that he behaves towards her. In the end, the fact that he's willing to, you know, throw her out to these, you know, sexual predators, and then on top of that, you know, desecrate her body by cutting it into 12 pieces. So anyway, it's pretty dark, but not completely removed from our own time and the values of the people who exist in our own culture. So questions? Yes, ma'am.
Well, I have some thoughts, several thoughts.
Okay, rock on. Let's have it.
So we've read the text. But one, you know, David Rutten in the Psalm.
And by the way, sorry I was reading it so slow. My eyes have just been going out. I've been having some problems. I need to start bringing my glasses with me. So anyway, yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
So with David, and I have several thoughts going on when I read it and as you're speaking. But you know, David writing in the Psalms, how can a young man keep his way pure by keeping it according to the word in your word? I've treasured my heart that I may not sin against you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, those are very powerful words.
Oh, yeah. But it speaks to the power of God's word, even to those under the system of the law.
Right.
Absolutely.
And so that makes me go, even though David was king and he had certain kings and judges and, were given the Spirit, whether it would just be for a time, I thought, for him to write those words and, how much more powerful is the Spirit living inside of a believer's heart continually when it comes to walking according to the Word of God and sinning against Him and all those things. We have a power that's continuously in us. So in a way, it's, for him to write this and not have that, that's like, whoa.
Well, right. It does speak to the power. But
right.
It speaks to the power of God's Word. In any dispensation.
Right. And then I was saying, as far as him going to her dad's house, when we're talking about her being the harlot, harlotry is just unfaithfulness. Unfaithfulness.
Yes. Right. So it doesn't have to have a sexual connotation.
Right. And she was unfaithful, leaving her husband, going to her father's house.
She broke the vow. She abandoned. Right. Yeah. She said, "I'm going to commit myself to you for life," and then she broke her word.
Right. And so when he went back again, it being me saying, I do believe that he was going back to truly get her, but that wasn't necessarily me saying it was a godly love.
Right.
Maybe it was a selfish love, more of a, what am I going to look like? My concubine took off on me.
Right.
Let me speak sweet to her, maybe manipulation, whatever, to get her back in my home.
Absolutely.
But I do believe his intent was to bring her home. And
as weak as it was,
right,
yes.
Right.
Now, we don't know what the motivation was.
Right.
But, and if you go with the Net Bible translation that she was angry at him, you look at his character later on. What kind of guy was he in the home?
Right.
Why did she? Because if it was that she wasn't unfaithful, but if she was angry at him,
absolutely,
then it raises question about his character.
Right.
Was he abusive? I mean, did he have a drug addiction to maintain? Was she his vehicle to make that happen?
I hadn't put that one into it, whether or not she was angry at him, but I wondered why she left to begin with.
Right. For 4 months.
Right.
And the thing about it, and this is again me, when you look at the culture and you look at the timing, I mean, he could have been a really horrible person, and that's why she left. I mean, it doesn't say anything to be, like he was a knight in shining armor or anything like
right.
that at all. But if you look at the timing, you look at the culture, you look at the law and the places of men and women, in general. But anyway, so when he was with the father, I was thinking of God's time and God's timing and how God works with his time and his timing. That this whatever reason that this father-in-law detained him, he would detain him throughout the day. And on the third time that he tried to detain him and said, leave in the afternoon, well, if they're traveling, they're going to need all day to travel. So if he is going to leave in the afternoon, of course they're going to be on the road at night, which is going to be more dangerous then. But his unwillingness, his... If you want to say, I just want to leave already. I'm going to leave. Doesn't matter what time it is.
Right. Yeah, he's ready to go.
He was unwilling to stay. It says he was unwilling to stay. That's his. If you want to talk in the church is his flesh saying, forget this. I'm being impatient. There you go.
Yes, and some people, when I thought of the father-in-law,
right.
There are some people that I deal with in my job who have certain cognitive disabilities, whether it's schizophrenia or something of that nature. And I run into people who are so self-absorbed that when they start talking, it doesn't matter what you say. They're just like the Energizer Bunny. They just keep going and going and going and going and going and going and going. And I had it happen just the other day. I walked into a place. I was talking with a lady. Her aide was there. And while I was talking with this lady, I mean, within about the first 30 seconds, I'm trying to get information, and she hijacked the conversation and launched into this about 10 minutes of her telling me about a favorite cooking pan that she had. And she went into talking about the color of the pan, the size of the pan, the dent that was on the edge of the pan, how the pan had served her well all these years, how she was going to give it to her daughter. And then it went into this story about how somebody stole the pan and now she's angry at this guy and on and on and on. And every time I tried to redirect, she would raise her voice and start talking more and more about the pan. And I'm like, well, ma'am, I understand. You know, I'm sorry for your loss, you know, so. And I'm trying to get this information. And every time I would try to interject, she would launch into, but I'm not finished with my story. And she would just raise her voice and start talking more about the pan. And finally, I looked over at the aide who was sitting in the room, and she was in eye shot to me, but the client I was with, she couldn't see her. And the aide just goes, just got to go. And she's lipping it to me. You know, I'm reading her lips, and she's just like, you just got to go. And so I went over, I shook my client's hand. I said, ma'am, I said, you know, have a good day. We'll keep you going. And I'm walking towards the door, and she's following me, and she's still talking. I said, okay, I'll see you later. And I get out the door, and she's still talking. She's following me out the door. This lady did not care about me, what I had to do there, what service I was providing. She was so self-absorbed that it was all about her. Now, I don't know that this is the case with the father-in-law, but it does seem that it's more about him. And really, throughout this whole chapter, maybe desperate for company, but he's so pushy in trying to get his son-in-law to stay that he's not really considerate. I mean, he's a good host. Right. He's probably the best character in the whole story, although I don't think he's free from selfishness. But it seems that so much of what he's doing is really inconsiderate of the man that he's wanting to make a good impression upon by entertaining. And so he keeps pushing him to stay until finally the Levite says that he was unwilling, and he finally has to just push himself out, even though he's being pressed upon by his father-in-law. And so, you know, again, is this indicative of reality, of the way people are? Sure. And at some point, you just have to break away. You just have to be unwilling to continue to stay in this person's company. You just got to go.
Like the woman that lived downstairs from us in the apartment. Remember, we had to walk away while she was still talking several times.
Yes. Yeah, you say goodbye like 3-4 times, and she just keeps talking. I'll never forget, I was visiting with a lady one time. I made a delivery to her. And I mean, she was worse than the lady I saw the other day. I mean, she was just, I hate to call her motor mouth, but that's kind of what she was, and just nonstop. And you couldn't say anything. And she'd get excited, and she'd raise her voice. And so finally, I'm walking out the door, she's still talking. I'm walking down the driveway, she's talking. I get in my truck, she's still talking. The windows are up, the truck is running, and she's standing in front of the truck, and she's still talking. I'm pulling out of the driveway, and she's following me down the driveway, and she's still talking. And I back up, and I wave to her, and she waves, and she's still talking. And I go down the road, I take off down, I kid you, I looked in the rearview mirror, and I could swear I could see her lips talking, standing at the end of the drive. And I just thought to myself, are you kidding me? But again, this is a woman with a cognitive impairment. And it's one of those things where it's like there are people in the world that are that way. And that's extreme, but they are there.
I had an aunt, of course, she's deceased now, that she was that way. I used to always say, I know that never die, put a period at the end of a sentence. She just gets
you never put a period, huh?
Never stop.
And yeah.
Now I have a cousin, Sandy.
Uh-huh.
Same side of the family. You must have the spirit of Mildred.
Yeah. And there are people that are that way. And sometimes you have to be unwilling to continue in their, quote, hospitality. You just simply have to go. So, anyway, another comment, question. Yes, ma'am.
But I had asked you, you know, before we started about the word seize, because in the English it's to take forcibly.
And where are you looking at that? Which verse are you looking at?
25. But men would not listen to him, so the man seized his concubine and brought her out to them. And then they rape her and abuse her all night until morning. But to seize, in the English it's to take forcibly.
Yes.
You know, and so, if, you know, absolutely, I'm sure that they were scared. The ladies were scared, and it only says that they did this to the concubine, not the virgin daughter.
Right, because she was the only one thrown out.
Right, and so the man seized his concubine to take forcibly. So that's why I was asking, you know, you would know more so than I in the original text or languages. Is there a word for seize that would mean maybe something a little different? Because
I don't remember looking at that particularly.
Is that grab, seize?
Because the only reason that I thought it was the man from the house and not the husband is because he seized her.
But the man, so it leads you to believe, like you say, you don't know which one it was. Was it the man of the house or whether it was the husband?
Right. And the husband absolutely is wrong for not protecting her.
Right. Yeah, there's a breakdown there either way.
Either way,
because if the Levite did not personally throw her out,
right,
then he was certainly passively complicit
right.
in allowing, because he certainly
right.
didn't throw up a fight to protect
right.
his concubine if the old man is the one who did in fact throw her out. And again, one can imagine that the concubine is throwing up some fight here because she doesn't want to go out. And but either way, she's put out.
Right.
Yeah.
The man took his concubine.
Uh huh.
So it led me to believe it was the husband.
So
yeah,
that, say,
that's kind of the way mine goes too.
Does yours say that he took his concubine or does
yeah,
he?
Yeah, it says the man took.
Yeah, different translations.
Yeah.
Right.
Grab.
Yeah.
Took.
Right.
Yeah, but
and
the but the idea is that it was done by force.
Oh.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
she was thrown out
so
against
she
her will.
Back. She put up a fight.
I think I can't imagine she didn't.
Yeah.
But she was she was.
She knew what was going to happen if she went out that door.
Huh? Yeah. And one can imagine the horror, you know, of the prospect of it all. And
y'all
then,
go ahead and go outside or go in another room, please, quickly.
He's still talking.
Yeah, not to mention, yeah, mm-hmm. Pastor's still talking, go away. But not to mention, you know, the betrayal.
Right, yes.
And then, you know, at the end of it all, she crawls back to the house.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, what a sad picture. You know, that she goes back and she's laying there with her hands, you know, sort of clutching the doorpost, you know.
I think she just didn't make it far enough to knock.
Right.
Yeah. I heard you later surmise that you thought she was dead.
Yeah.
I think she was dead.
When he put her on the donkey, she was dead.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. And then took her home and then dismembered her. The reason I say that is because, and it doesn't say whether she was dead or unconscious. But if she, by a group of men being beat and raped all night, you know what I mean? It's going to be hard to survive that.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, and then.
I'd want to die after that.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you live with that? What?
Right.
Yeah. Talk about post-traumatic
right.
stress disorder.
And again, from it ended up being a civil war, and later the purging, the way the civil. And the reason I say time and timing. Because if they hadn't left in the afternoon, they wouldn't have been there to be in the open square in the middle of the night for this to take place.
Yes.
But for him to be so impatient to go ahead and leave anyway, you know, with...
you know, yeah, right. You can find almost everybody here at fault.
Right.
True.
Okay?
Yes.
Even to some degree, the concubine. That's not to try to diminish in any way what she went through. But if she hadn't left, if she hadn't gone back home to Dad, then the situation wouldn't have resulted. You know, it wouldn't have turned out the way that it did. What's crazy, and of course when we get into the next chapter, and we're going to break it into two parts because it is more than I can bite off in one section, but it's the fact that when the other tribes come into the area of Benjamin to try to deal with these men,
right.
the Benjamites won't give them up.
Right.
Now that speaks.
Them, yeah.
Now that's they protect him. Now that speaks of how far that whole tribe
right.
had become degenerate. The fact that they were willing to protect these few guys, and the fact that so many thousands were willing to die to protect them.
Right.
It just is absolutely crazy. And yet you read through this sort of stuff. And you could very easily put this in the Middle East today,
right?
With what's going on with ISIS
right.
and the way that they're treating Christians and wives,
right.
they have sex slaves. How they're abusing and raping women
right.
to the point of death. I mean, this is again, it's an ancient story, but it's contemporary.
Right. And what I was going to say when I was reading this from the very beginning,
uh-huh.
we're leaving,
yeah,
until the end of the chapter is God's judgment, God's judgment, God's judgment, God's judgment.
Yeah.
You know, and it ends in the Civil War, and then the purging, and then I see election there, the purging of the Benjamites and the very few that were saved, you know, I thought when he took her home and he cut her up, that was for, he knew the response he would probably get, sending these pieces out, and that was for his, I guess, if you will, to cover up his shame and his pride. Because if you look, she's a concubine. She's not the first wife.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So when you look, well, she has less, I guess, rights, less privileges
yeah.
than the first wife. So I could see, not that it makes it right, it's disgusting,
mm-hmm.
and it's perverse, and it's twisted, and it's horrible and heartbreaking. But, you know, I don't want to say, of course, he's doing this to the concubine and not the first wife.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she left him. She looked like a slap in the face for so long.
Again, yeah.
I mean, all these different things, but it's the judgment of God over and over and over and over again.
It is. And if he treats his concubine this way, I mean, it does raise the question, you know, did he have other concubines? You know, he's already practicing polygamy, so is this just wife number two, or is this wife number nine? And how is he treating the others? I mean, you know, it just raises some pretty serious questions, so.
Well, they're under the law, so they're not supposed to take many wives anyway.
The law, the kings were absolutely forbidden.
Right, okay.
The kings, if you look at Leviticus 17, the kings were absolutely forbidden.
Right.
And yet, David had multiple wives. I forget how many he had, but it was about half a dozen or so. And he had concubines, too, because if you remember when his son Absalom tried to usurp the throne, that his son Absalom had sexual relations with David's concubines up on the roof. I mean, it was in a public area.
Mm-hmm.
But he did it in such a way so as to say, I've not only taken the throne, but I've taken your wives as well. So David had concubines also. Of course, Solomon, he seems to hold the world record, I think, as far as wives and concubines. And a lot of that, you know, scholars say was due to political alliances that he was having, marrying the daughter of some, you know, little king or prince over here in order to maintain some alliance.
Right.
It's hard to say. The text doesn't really tell us that. But he broke the law. But under the law did not prohibit polygamy. But neither did it promote it.
Right.
It sought to regulate it.
Right.
And that was one of those things where it was like it was not God's original intention. When it came to marriage, it was one man, one woman. Genesis 2:24 is pretty clear on that. And Christ reiterated that, of course, you know, during his time upon the earth. But when you look at the law did seek to regulate a practice that was going on in Israel at this time. So it wasn't promoted. It was permitted, regulated, but it was not God's ultimate intention. And God, I hate to almost use the word, but I'm going to use it because I can't think of anything else. But God tolerates sin.
Mm-hmm.
Now, not all sin is the same. Some sin God tolerates, and some sin he does not tolerate.
Mm-hmm.
He permitted David to have multiple wives, but he did not permit David without punishment.
Right.
With regard to Bathsheba,
right.
Okay, so you know it was the severity of the sin I think that brought the punishment. But there are some sins that God did permit in the lives of His people. Yes, but here's another issue on that is if you think about the consequences for murder and adultery, both consequences under the law were death,
right.
And David didn't die.
Right.
Remember when Nathan came before him and gave him the parable, and David gets outraged, and David says, "You're the man."
But don't worry, you won't die.
Right.
But why? Why did that statement come from Nathan? I think it's because of David's comment where David immediately confessed his sin. David displayed some level of contrition. And he said, "I'm guilty, I'm the man, I did it." He immediately confessed his sin. I mean, the text says that. And then the very next verse is that Nathan said to him, the Lord has forgiven you. You will not die.
Because under the law you deserve to.
Yeah, right. So even though the law mandated the punishment, there were times where God demonstrated mercy. Mm-hmm. Even though he gave the law that demanded punishment, there were times where God could back off with regard to the execution of the punishment.
So you.
Right. But I think that part of that is that God was willing to be merciful and not extend the punishment that the law required if there was some level of contrition on the guilty person's part. And David displays that.
But he permitted the child to die, didn't he?
He did, and that was the punishment. So there was some punishment that came upon David, but it wasn't the punishment of death that was required under the law. In other words, even though the law mandated death, there was some room there for mercy if there was a level of contrition upon the guilty party. And I think God himself displays that. And I guess that's my point, is that you can have believers like David who throughout his time when he's king will be engaging in sin where he is where he's accumulating wives, where he's doing certain things that are in violation of the command set forth for kings under the law. And yet there were some things that God permitted in the life of David, and I would argue in the life of every believer, I might add, because of the attitude of humility that the believer has. It's like, you know, I was having a discussion one time with a guy where he was, you know, we were talking about his sin, and he didn't want to talk about it because he was very much loved his sin. He was public about it. He enjoyed it. And the response was, he says, well, what? And you don't have sin? I said, of course I do. I just don't celebrate it. I just don't celebrate it publicly. And two, when I commit it, I acknowledge it for what it is. It's sin. It is a violation of God's word and God's character, and I call it for exactly what it is, and I confess it before Almighty God that I have sinned. I never try to hide it. I admit it, and I own it, and if there's some punishment, then I deserve it. But unlike this other guy, he celebrated his sin. For him, it was a very public thing. It was nothing to be ashamed of. He celebrated. And so I think that's the difference, where you have some people, even believers, who celebrate their sin. And so when the punishment comes upon them in a very heavy way, it's because there is absolutely no humility on their part with regard to their behavior before a holy God. And, you know, when I see David and the way that he behaves, I think, I think that explains why God did not come down so heavy on David and other believers. I would argue all believers, as a matter of fact. But you know, with regard to going back to the text here, you realize that, you know, God is nowhere mentioned in any of this. I mean, you don't find the name of the Lord. You don't find any command of the Lord. I mean, you find lots of violation.
Well, that's how the story ends out, because there's nothing about the Lord in it.
Right, right. And it's so not until the next chapter that you have Israelites actually seeking out the Lord. What? They should have been doing that long before. But again, it took this kick in the pants to bring them to the place to where they would begin to seek out the Lord, you know, as to what to do. Because the wickedness had become so extensive and so bad that it had to be dealt with. And only the Lord's solution would satisfy, would work. So, anyway, yes, ma'am?
I'm not saying that there wasn't any love for concubines.
Okay.
Or there wasn't any love for wives or anything. But again, with the culture, the law, or the place and positions of women and men and the concubines, mm-hmm. you know, there wasn't that, the whole one man, what there was in the garden. But I mean, as far as Christ and the church and that kind of love and that man, the woman and man relationship, husband and wife relationship, and this is kind of like that, you know, how would I put it? I don't see him sacrificing himself for his concubines.
Right.
These men, not just one, exactly, not
it,
just one
cold.
Man, but men want to rape him.
Yeah.
Want to have him all night long. And so I don't see him throwing himself in front of his concubine.
Right.
Once she gets thrown out there,
right.
It's like, you know, so when we get up in the morning, we got to go. We're shamed all over the place. Let's go home. Oh, wait, you're dead. So now I'm going to go and seek revenge for my own pride.
Yeah.
And I know, you know, because you're my concubine, they're going to be like, well, that was his possession.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Kind of thing. I don't know if I lost everybody there.
Yeah. Right. And what we have here is an example of how people should not behave.
Self.
Exactly. Look, everybody in this chapter,
right,
from the Levite to the concubine to the father-in-law to the old man to the sexual predators, it's just like everybody's out for themselves.
Right.
You know, it's what's good for them. Now, it may come in different degrees of severity, mm-hmm. In how that's borne out, but yeah, the whole chapter is just, it really just seems to predominantly be about self. And so it's a picture, and with regard to the way the man treated his wife, it's the absolute antithesis of how a man should regard his wife,
right.
You know, or really anybody that he loves. I'll be honest, it makes me angry. It makes me angry at the sexual predators. It makes me angry at the Levite who throws his concubine out and the way he treats her. You know, and it's hard not to be, I think, you know, so.
It broke my heart.
Yeah.
Sick. Made me
yeah. Naturally so. Any other questions or comments while we take a break?
Real quick one.
Yes, sir.
In the beginning, I was talking about the certain Levites. Could that have been Jonathan by any Swinson?
Well, the text doesn't say. And other commentators mention that it could have been Jonathan. But
some clearly say it wasn't. Some clearly say it was. How would they even make that statement?
You couldn't. There's no place for dogmatism on those sorts of statements. Because there's nothing in the text. I mean, it just simply reads a certain Levite.
Is there something in historical data at that time?
No, there's nothing in the biblical text that would lead one to conclude that it was Jonathan from the previous chapter. There's no extra biblical material, at least none that I'm aware of. So I just kind of left it alone. And there's really, is there anybody here that's given a name? I mean, you have the Levite, you have the concubine, you got the father-in-law, you got the old man, you got the sexual predators. I don't know that anybody's named in the chapter.
The land and the tribes. That's it.
Just the land and the tribes. Yeah. Yeah. The city they went to, but other than that, it's and I don't even know that it's really important that you have specific names. To explain the event. But again, when you're looking at the life of Israel during the 300-year time period of the judges, they come out of Egypt. They're in the wilderness for 40 years. Moses dies. Joshua brings them into the land, and they're at such a high point. They're at such a high point in their obedience to the Lord, in the blessing. And by the time you get to the opening chapter of Judges, you have a turning away from the Lord and a failure to take the land, and immediately all these people are left in the land when they should have been driven out. And remember what God said. He said, if you permit them, then they will become a corrupting influence. And they will lead you into idolatry. And everything that follows from there is a result of that initial disobedience that happened by that first generation that followed Joshua when they came into the land. After Joshua died, those decisions set the precedent for all of their children for years to come, because they grew up in this paganized culture where God had been excluded, idolatry was the practice of the day, and anything went. And so this is a picture of a culture where God is excluded. And it's a sad commentary on Israel's history. And then, of course, you have certain high points. I mean, you have under David, you have under Solomon certain high points, but even Solomon introduces idolatry. You read the last days of Solomon's life. He introduces idolatry back in the land. Kingdom split. 10 northern tribes, they go in the ways of Jeroboam, right? And they begin to have idolatry continued on there. And idolatry began to plague the southern tribes until eventually they were both destroyed. The 10 northern tribes in 722, the southern tribes in 586 BC, they're eventually both destroyed because of their idolatry and turning away from the Lord. But it shows how depraved the culture can get. So it's a picture. It's a glimpse. It's a snapshot into their culture and what was going on at that particular time in Israel's history when God was shut out from their lives. And, Israel's history is, like this. It's up and down, up and down, up and down. And yet it's a picture sometimes of the lives of people as well. So, yes, ma'am.
I was thinking about God, them not honoring God, them not, And I thought the only protection in this story was pride.
Yeah. It was all about self. When God's excluded, you're just left with yourself. Yeah, and you think of, again, David's word in the Psalms. How can a young man keep his way pure? By keeping it according to your word. So, all right, well, let's take a break and we'll come back and finish up the summary points.